Oh, look at that. So I got three now. I'm parched. I think he used that, right? Okay, I'm not going to do that to you. All right. So we pick up, we've been in at the book of Esther. We know Esther was brought before the king and made queen. She is a Jewess, but nobody knows that. Her cousin, who basically raised her, Mordecai, sits in the gate of Shushan, the citadel, the winter home of King Ahasuerus, who is Xerxes. And, you know, throughout history, Satan has plotted to wipe out the children of Israel, the Jewish people, because we know that the covenant of Abraham and the promise that was given to him was that his seed would be an everlasting seed, and so that Jesus Christ, the Messiah, would come through Abraham and through the children of Israel. God chose that people and set them apart. And so Satan plots to wipe Israel out during the Persian Empire and the rule of Xerxes, and in the person of a man named Haman. And don't worry, I'm not reading it yet. Somebody was ready. And so Haman gets Ahasuerus to make a knee-jerk decision to allow the killing of all of the Jews in the Persian Empire. That would even include those that were in Jerusalem, sent back by Cyrus to begin and complete the rebuilding of the temple. And so that trouble was to come their way also. And we know that Mordecai is very aware of what's going on and tells Esther that she needs to do something. And Esther, there really wasn't anything Esther could do but to go before the king, which was a dangerous proposition, because if you went before the king and he did not receive you into his presence, you would be put to death on the spot. And so we know that she was kind of waffling, not sure that she really could do anything. And Mordecai, those great words, "For such a time as this, who knows that the Lord has not put you there for such a time as this." And when you look through, you know, and God behind the scenes, God not mentioned in name anywhere in the book of Esther, yet he is inscribed purposefully by the writer of Hebrews in certain verses, the YHWH, the transgrammaton, or the tetragrammaton, right? Tetragrammaton. And so we know that he is behind the scenes. The sovereignty of God is at work and all this. Just, you know, you think about Joseph, sold into slavery by his brothers, taken to Egypt, sold to Potiphar as a slave, becomes the manager, the head of Potiphar's household. Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him. He won't give in, ends up in prison. Ultimately, to get out of prison and to speak into the life of Pharaoh and to become the prime minister of Egypt, all for the purpose of, you know, saving and being there for when famine hit the land and Jacob and his family would need a place to be able to feed his family. And there was Jacob. So same thing here. God has raised up this young woman, has her placed specifically for this time. And so the king, verse 7, and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. You know, Proverbs 16:5 says, "Everyone proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Though they join forces, none will go unpunished." And then also Ecclesiastes 8:11, Solomon wrote, "Because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. That idea that, well, God hasn't done anything to me yet, or there is no God, so, you know, what does it matter? But there are a lot of people that think that what they're doing is good because God hasn't done anything yet. You know, the scriptures say the long suffering of God is for the singular purpose to bring, you know, to see men repent, men and women repent and turn to Him. I mean, and that's why God doesn't just wipe everybody out. The grace of God. So on the second day at the banquet of wine, remember, she already had one banquet, and she said, you know what, let's get together again. We'll have another banquet of wine. And in the meantime, who's it got? Haman. Haman suggests to Ahasuerus, man, I think you ought to really lay it on, you know, a certain person. He thought that he was going to be blessed by him and get this, you know, the robe and be led around to say, hey, you should do for that guy, lead him around on the royal horse, wearing the royal robes, really put him on display, because he thought he was the one that was going to benefit from that, and it ended up being Mordecai. And so he had just had to lead Mordecai around to get all of this recognition for what Mordecai had done in saving the king. And so Esther said, let's get together again tomorrow, so that, and not knowing, she didn't know that this was going to happen. Obviously, God just put it on her heart to delay giving her petition to the king. On the second day, the king again said to Esther, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom. It shall be done. Then Queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. And so she's begging for her life. So the king, not aware that she is a Jewess, that Mordecai is a Jew, is probably a little bit miffed. You know, she's not asking for wealth or power. She already got the position of queen. Obviously, he loves her a great deal because he has reached out his scepter to her to allow her to come into his presence, even to be offered the opportunity for a petition. But she starts out by asking for her own life and for the life of her people. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. Remember, Haman said that I will bring in the 10,000 pieces of silver to pay for the slaughter of the Jewish people. And then the king said, whatever, you know, is available in the king's storehouse will be given to you. And so what she's saying is, the person that's coming against my life, the reason I'm asking for the petition, can't pay for what, you know, what he is conspiring to do. He could never compensate for the king's loss, even if it were that they would be sold into slavery. Proverbs 16:3 says, commit your works to the Lord and your thoughts will be established. The Lord has made all for himself, yes, even the wicked, for the day of doom. And the king is right now going to find out that he decreed the death of his wife and the man who saved his life, because he foolishly granted Haman's request. And it says, so King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, who is he and where is he? Who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. He was terrified because, and we've talked about this, Xerxes was known to have a very short fuse and rage and anger quite often. Haman had been made the prime minister, and he's had time to be around King Xerxes. So he knows that as King Xerxes is about to storm off, that it is a fit of rage. And so he's terrified now that his plot has been found out, and that the plot that he had to kill all the Jews was actually putting the queen in danger. And he knows that Xerxes loves Esther. And it says, Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. And that is, in chapter 7, verse 7, is one of the encryptions of the YHWH, in that evil was determined against him. When the king returned from the palace garden, the reason that to point that out is God is behind the thing. God is at work here. And the writer of Esther, although you never see Jehovah Elohim, the name of the Lord, the tetragrammaton, he purposefully encrypts this into the text so that the reader would know. And so when the king returned from the palace to the place, the palace garden, to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. And so what happened was he knew he wasn't going to get any mercy from the king. He knew that when the king came back, that wrath was going to be pointed at him, that he was done for. And so his only other option was to seek the mercy of the queen. Yet he does so foolishly as he falls across her lap, evidently. And the king comes back and sees Haman on his queen. He just has sealed it, right? And he says, then the king said, "Will he also assault the queen while I am in the house?" As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now, Harbonah, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, Harbonah, being one of the eunuchs, was very one of the trusted advisors and had heard how Haman was going to build the gallows to kill Mordecai. And so he sees the opportunity here to let it be known to the king. He says, one of the eunuchs said to the king, "Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." And the king said, "Hang him on it." Yay! Oh, sorry, let's get off. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's wrath subsided. Proverbs 11:8, "The righteous is delivered from trouble, and it comes to the wicked instead." And these are proverbs. It's going to happen. Just like Asaph, and I always go, I love to, you know, just kind of go back and reconsider, and because we all are frustrated by what's going on in the world today. You know, a guy like Putin who's evil, it seems like he's getting away because nobody's willing to stand up, you know, and do what's right. But we have Asaph who he almost gave up the ministry. He almost threw his hands up in the air. "I'm never going back into the temple again and serving the Lord, because what's the use? The wicked, the evil, they prosper. They get away with everything that they're doing. They keep getting richer. What's the sense of it?" But instead of giving in, he went into the temple, and it said, "Until I went into the temple of the Lord and I saw their end. I saw what was coming." That's the truth of everything that we see going on even in the world today. They will get what's coming to them. Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 through 9, "Do not be deceived, God is not mocked. For that which a man sows, that will he also reap. For whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart." Do not lose heart. Mordecai did not lose heart. Esther did not lose heart. She was afraid, no doubt. There was nothing she could really do, nothing else she could really do. Job 4:8, "Even as I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same." And in Proverbs 22:8, "He who sows iniquity will reap sorrow, and the rod of his anger will fail." The principle of sowing and reaping is found throughout the Scriptures, the warnings of God, and the failings of man. That's what reaping and sowing is about. It applies to believers, and it applies to unbelievers alike. Jacob killed, remember, he killed an animal, put on a bunch of fur. His mother gave him a furry skin to wear and took a stew in that his father loved, deceived his father, stole the birthright, but he had killed the animal to do it. Later, his sons would kill an animal and come to him and lie and say that his son Joseph was dead. It was the blood of his son Joseph. Pharaoh ordered the killing of all the male Jewish babies. And the son of Pharaoh was ultimately killed by the death angel on Passover, and his army wiped out in the Red Sea. David slept with his neighbor's wife. He committed adultery. Then he killed that neighbor, his general, as he sent him into battle and told the rest of them to withdraw so that he would be taken out. Well, David's daughter Tamar was raped by her half-brother Amnon. His son Absalom slept with all of his concubines and was ultimately killed in battle. The son of his adultery died soon after his birth. Hosea chapter 8, verse 7, at the beginning, "They sow the wind and reap the whirlwind." And the principle is the consequences will be worse than the sin. Proverbs 1:27, "When your terror comes like a storm and your destruction comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you." Proverbs 10:25, "When the whirlwind passes by, the wicked is no more, but the righteous has an everlasting foundation." Jeremiah 23:19, "Behold, a whirlwind of the Lord has gone forth in fury, a violent whirlwind. It will fall violently on the head of the wicked." And Nahum 1:3, "The Lord is slow to anger." Who is that guy again, Kevin? Gail Irwin. "The Lord is slow to anger and great in power. He will not at all acquit the wicked. The Lord has his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet." Paul persecuted the Christians, endorsed the stoning of Stephen. He suffered the consequences of that in his ministry. For the name of the Lord, he persecuted those who followed Jesus Christ, but once he became a follower himself, he reaped that which he had sowed. God allows that in our lives. It strengthens us. And, you know, sometimes some of us need a little bit more of it than others. How many of you are hard-headed? It seems like God has to, yeah. But here's what Paul says, 2 Corinthians 11:23, "Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often." These are all things that he caused Christians to suffer as he went around to destroy Christianity. His intent on the road to Damascus was to go and to imprison all of the Christians in Damascus. And it said, from the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have been in the deep. In journeys often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness, besides the other things, what come upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. You know, and I don't know that I'll ever know, but you know, the years of drinking and stuff like that, who knows, you know, blood pressure and sugar struggles and all these other things, if that just wasn't from the years of abuse. Sowing and reaping, though, and here's the good news, Christian, sowing and reaping also applies to acts of righteousness and good works. Remember it said, sow to the Spirit and reap of the Spirit everlasting life. It's why we're encouraged to good works, not so that we can score points, but that we sow, you know, to the Spirit, those things that will make a difference, that really matter in eternity. A gentleman by the name of C.T. Studd wrote a poem. It says, two little lines I heard one day, traveling along life's busy way, bringing conviction to my heart, and from my mind would not depart. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. Only one life, yes, only one. Soon will its fleeting hours be done. Then in that day, my Lord to meet and stand before His judgment seat. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. Only one life, the still small voice gently pleads for a better choice, bidding me selfish aims to leave and to God's holy will to cleave. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. Only one life, a few brief years, each with its burdens, hopes, and fears, each with its clays I must fulfill, living for self or in His will. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. When this bright world would tempt me sore, when Satan would a victory score, when self would seek to have its way, then help me, Lord, with joy to say, only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will ask. Give me, Father, a purpose deep, in joy or sorrow thy word to keep, faithful and true, whate'er the strife, pleasing thee in my daily life. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. Oh, let my love with fervor burn, and from the world now let me turn, living for thee and thee alone, bringing thee pleasure on thy throne. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. Only one life, yes, only one. Now let me say, thy will be done. And when at last I hear the call, I know I'll say, 'twas worth it all. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. And there's one extra stanza, and it says, only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. And when I am dying, how happy I'll be if the lamp of my life has burned out for thee. Sow to the wind, reap the whirlwind. Sow to the flesh, you'll reap destruction. Sow to the Spirit, everlasting life. On that day, chapter 8, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king for Esther, and said how he was related to her. And so now the king's going to start finding out all the behind the stories. And by giving, remember, he was a very wealthy man, Haman. And by giving Esther the house of Haman, that is all of his wealth, all of his riches, all of his holdings, all everything. And she's going to give it to Mordecai to keep. And it says, the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now, Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman, the Agagite, and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, if it pleases the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, which, yes, 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 let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of the Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? How can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen? Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai, the Jew, indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews as you please, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke. So now Mordecai has been made the prime minister in place of Haman. And we have talked about it, the Code of Hammurabi. Once a decree is made, it cannot be changed, not even by the king. And that's what he basically said. You're going to have to write out instructions, and the instructions basically can't say that decree is revoked. We're going to see that the decree will be made that the Jews can defend themselves. And we need to understand that they were allowed to defend themselves, because a lot of people come to this scripture, I can't believe that God, I mean, Mordecai is going to write out instructions for the slaughter of all of these Persians. No. Instructions were made for the slaughter of the Jews. Mordecai and Esther are going to send out communications that the Jews are allowed to defend themselves if the Persians decide, that the citizens of Persia decide to carry out that original order. And it's going to be made known to everybody that the Jews are going to defend themselves. And ultimately, we're going to see that Persians will end up dying, even though they understand and know that this decree came out from the king that the Jews were allowed to defend themselves. And whoever they took out, by the way, they could take their stuff too. Now we're going to see that the Jews didn't follow up on that, but they are going to defend themselves. You know, the improper interpretation of Scripture and understanding of what's going on has caused a lot of people to question the goodness of the Old Testament God, you know, and even the understanding of the commandment, thou shalt not commit murder. Jesus is the one that defined that. Thou shalt not kill is the way that it's translated in so many ways. But it's the understanding of premeditated murder. Jesus said, thou shalt not commit murder. And God never warrants the murder of anybody. And so Mordecai, what Mordecai does is absolutely okay. God's okay with his children defending themselves, protecting themselves. When they're not to, he lets them know. In the case of the children of Israel, when Nebuchadnezzar was coming, he had a guy by the name of Jeremiah that was going around saying, don't take up arms. When the king and his men come, hand yourself over. Go into captivity. That is God's, you know, God's chastisement upon us for what we have done. And if you go, then you'll prosper in that land. But if not, you're going to die. And he warns the children of Israel when they're not to defend themselves. So, very interesting. So the king's scribes, well, let me say this. It says, Psalm 37, verse 34 through 36, wait on the Lord and keep his way, and he shall exalt you to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, you shall see it. I have seen, verse 35, the wicked in great power and spreading himself like a native green tree. That's what we're watching today. I'm not just talking about one ruler, one lead, national or one leader of nations. It's pretty much pandemic of all of the nation's rulers today. Verse 36, yet he passed away, and behold, he was no more. Indeed, I sought him, but he could not be found. God will have his day. Judgment's going to come, the whirlwind. Judgment comes in the whirlwind. And so the king's scribes were called at that time, verse 9, in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day, as it was written, according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews. Oh yeah, Mordecai. To the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all, and to every province in its own script, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding on royal horses bred from swift steeds. And we talked about that. Persia had one of the, before the Pony Express, and the Pony Express, and then they had the Wells Fargo, and then so they were probably more advanced than anybody. Every certain amount of miles, they would have an actual house where the riders could get a meal, change horses. They were the best of the best of the horses, and that's how they got word out, and it would just spread out from there. So, by these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. Anybody that decided that they were going to carry out Haman's decree would face a very stiff defense, protecting themselves. On one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, a copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province and published for all people, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers who rode on royal horses went out, hastened and pressed on by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Shushan, the citadel. So Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness, joy, and honor. What a turn of events. They had a queen who was a Jew, and a Jew also that saved the king, was now the prime minister. All placed by God. In the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, chapter 9, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. The Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could withstand them because fear of them fell upon all the people. And even though they feared, and this was a king's decree that was against the decree that had gone out before. Look, anti-Semitism has existed for a very, very, very long time. About 75,000 people across Persia, even though they understood that the Jews were going to protect themselves, they hated the Jewish people so much, they were going to try and kill them anyways. The Jews gathered together, and all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. Mordecai was the prime minister, and the word came out. That idea of the fear that fell upon them, you know, Rahab, when she was in Jericho, when the spies came in, they said, hey, look, for 40 years, you know, the fear of your people has been upon those in Jericho because they know Jehovah God is with you and led you out of Egypt and was bringing you here. That fear, knowing that there was God was behind what was going on. For Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For this man, Mordecai, became increasingly prominent. Thus, the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. And in Shushan, the citadel, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. So 500, even where the king was and where Mordecai was, and even though that they knew that this had come out, they still were going to go out and try and kill the Jews. And Shushan, also hard name, down to 10, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, they killed. Oh, Haman, you've missed that. Then the 10 sons of Haman. Genie, give me a boo. Okay. But they did not lay a hand on the plunder. On that day, the number of those who were killed in Shushan, the citadel, was brought to the king. And the king said to the queen, to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men in Shushan, the citadel, the 10 sons of Haman, and have, what have they done? Who yayed Haman? Oh. What have they done in the rest of the king's province? I'm going to call Rabbi Glenn and tell him I would cross Greg off the list for Purim this coming year because he's going to mess it all up. Now, what is your petition? It shall be granted to you. Or what is your further request? It shall be done. And Esther said, if it pleases the king, let it be granted to the Jews who are in Shushan to go do again tomorrow according to today's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. So the king commanded this to be done. The decree was issued in Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. The Jews who were in Shushan gathered together again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men at Shushan, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. So they weren't doing it, you know, retaliatory. They were protecting themselves. They had no need. They were prospering in Persia. They had no need for the goods of the people who came after them. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th of the month they rested, made it a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day as well as on the 14th. And on the 15th of the month they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who dwelt in the unwalled towns celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar with gladness and feasting as a holiday for sending presents to one another. It would also be a holiday and a time when they would help the poor. They would send gifts to the poor. Mordecai wrote these things. Sent letters to all the Jews near and far and who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar as the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies. as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted the custom which they had begun, as Mordecai had written to them, because Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to annihilate them, and had cast Pur, and that Pur means the lot, Babylonian word for lot, to consume them and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letter that this wicked plot which Haman had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. So they called these days Purim, after the name Pur, lot. Purim is the plural. Lots, therefore, because of all the words of this letter, what they had seen concerning this matter and what had happened to them, the Jews established and opposed it upon themselves and their descendants and all who would join them, that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year, according to the written instructions and according to the prescribed time, that these days should be remembered, kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city. But these days of Purim should not fail to be observed among the Jews, and that the memory of them should not perish among their descendants. And so they established Purim, and I've talked about it, Rabbi Glenn's congregation on, I have to look and see what it is on the calendar, the 14th and 15th day of Adar, but they get together and they dress up and they bring rattles and crazy sound making things, and I mean they dress in some crazy garb and they boo and hooray and stand up and make all kinds of noise and have a good old time celebrating Purim. And Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai, the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter about Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, with words of peace and truth, to confirm these days of Purim at their appointed time, as Mordecai, the Jew, and Queen Esther had prescribed for them, and as they had decreed for themselves and their descendants concerning matters of their fasting and lamenting. So the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. Theologian Jaroslav Pelikan wrote this: tradition is the living faith of the dead, but traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. And there's a lot of traditionalism that has taken over the church. But there's nothing wrong with tradition and the reminding, because that's what God had commanded the children of Israel to pass down from generation to generation. We are one generation from the death of the church. You understand that, right? And it's important that traditions of the church are passed on, but that we don't become traditionalists, the observing for the sake of observance, right? The purpose of Purim, as well as all the Jewish feasts, was for remembrance. It became a legalism to them. They just practiced it instead of remembering God's protection, deliverance, redemption, and salvation throughout history. And I believe we must recognize, you know, and in this too, that there are certain traditions that are very important, right? Communion, baptism, they are good, but not for the purpose of salvation, but to remind us and as a remembrance of what Jesus Christ has done for us. He is the salvation of God to all who will believe. And so, You know, we see that in this. King Ahasuerus, chapter 10, imposed tribute on the land and on the islands of the sea, and all the acts of his power and his might, and the account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus, and was great among the Jews, and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his countrymen. And so, for such a time as this, you know, and it's important not to miss, because it's not mentioned. We know that Esther instructed Mordecai to go and to fast, right, and put on sackcloth. We never hear her suggest and pray, right, or beseech God. Yet it's very clear the message that God has given us, that Esther was an intercessor, just as Moses was. There wasn't anything else she could do but go before the king on behalf of her people, right? She approached the throne and sought the mercy of the king. And it's such a simple act in the face of overwhelming odds. There was nothing else she could do. And sometimes we fret and we worry and oh Lord, I can't, there's nothing I can do. There's nothing I can do. When it's very clear that there is something that we can do. We often forget our position as God's children and that we are here for such a time as this. Not that we have any power or authority, but our Father does. And we serve the King of Kings. Hebrews 4, 14 through 16, seeing that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted and tested as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in the time of need. And I think we see that in what Mordecai instructed Esther to do in a mortal sense, in the temporal sense, by her approaching the king who had the authority, right? We have a king, we have a Father in heaven who has all authority to intercede, right? And he's working behind the scenes. And we know that, but sometimes we forget it, right? We allow ourselves to be overwhelmed by what's going on. Esther was almost overwhelmed, right? If I go in, he can kill me. Well, guess what? If you don't, you're going to die anyways, right? So why don't you just go in and obtain grace and find mercy for help in a time of need? Look, that's pretty simple. There's nothing really we can do about what's going on in this world other than we can pray, right? Exercise. Just so you know, there's a petition for, and we have it out there. Make sure that if you're from Oakland County, you sign Oakland County. And if you're from Macomb, you sign Macomb. But we're going to support it. We believe that it's imperative of our freedoms that you must show identification in order to vote. That they make it a law. So there's no more. So we have that petition out on the table. We can do that. But it's more important that we often come boldly to God's throne of grace and find mercy in our time of need. In a time of need of our brothers and sisters and loved ones. Especially in these times. Time is growing short. Amen.